Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Having a Ball podcast. I'm your host, Ziva.
And I'm Erica.
And today we're going to be doing something a little bit different. Today we are going to do Having a Ball podcast presents Hollywood Mysteries.
Woo!
We're excited. So as we mentioned in our earlier episode, and I think we've mentioned it a few times, we're trying to give you the Lucille Ball content that you love, but also different content as well that others might enjoy as well. And I think before we even get into this, we should talk about how we both thought about doing a crime podcast before we met each other.
Yeah, it would see, like, for example, this is our introductory episode to this, you know, half of portion of Having a Ball. And I wanted to do, without even knowing Ziva, this is a little over a year ago, a episode on George Reeves, kind of a true crime Hollywood mystery. Now, those are a dime a dozen. We see them all over the place, but there's a reason for it because they're fascinating. And so to me, that's what I wanted to do before, you know, we started the Lucille Ball podcast or the I Love Lucy podcast. So I had a whole script right now ready to go and recorded it and everything. And then fate would have it and I would meet Ziva and we'd be doing this podcast. So, you know, kind of put aside. And I think that's something that you wanted to do too.
Oh yeah. I was not so much the Hollywood mysteries and things like that, but just all cases in general, really. I'm just super interested in actually considered being a profiler.
Okay.
And
I think it's like I mentioned, I mean, CrimeCon was just happening in Las Vegas and podcasts have exploded over the last couple of years with true crime, Hollywood true crime, normal everyday people true crime. And so that's what we're doing. And what I like is that we're starting off kind of like in an old Hollywood, you know, format. Maybe not always, we're not sticking to that. Perhaps we'll move around. But I think this is a nice, and we can always find a connection to Lucy. Like, for example, George Reeves has a connection to Lucy.
Yes, he does.
So this is a little, you know, episode on George Reeves, which of course was not the first, but the second Superman. And so the first one was Kirk Allen was the one who did Superman first. And, you know, this death of George Reeves was really a mystery, continues to be, because even though it was ruled a suicide by the LAPD, within a week, it was shut
so quickly, you
know, closed. And the mishandling of this case is just, it's frustrating. But so he was a hero, not only, you know, to television viewers, indestructible and invincible to adults and children alike, really. And the year was 1959. And the headlines really shocked the nation as the news spread that the actor had apparently taken his own life at his home on Benedict Canyon, which is still up today. It's still, you know, around. The house is still, it hasn't been demolished or anything. And just a side note, you know, the people who bought the house were aware.
Did you trespass there too?
I did not. How dare you? And so I will. And so they were aware that this house was, you know, where George Reeves passed, and they claimed that there was ghosts and things like that, but it was probably more to get attention than reality. And so he apparently had taken his own life on Benedict Canyon. And while the cause of death was indeed a speeding bullet, the conspiracy and the mystery remains as to whether it was in fact a suicide, a homicide perpetrated by either a jealous married lover's husband. I mean, right?
Or a married woman, because we'll talk about this, but the scorned lover, I mean, she was incredibly jealous and like hurt and did a bunch of things before that we'll talk about when we get to that. So,
or a party girl that he was engaged to, or even the mob was introduced to this death. And his death at only 45 remains a controversial and mysterious subject and was the focus of the 2006 film starring Ben Affleck and Adrian Brody titled Hollywoodland. And we'll dive into this episode. We'll discuss how not everyone is on board with the notion that he took his own life. Have you seen Hollywoodland?
I haven't. I thought about it, but
yeah, it's a great film. It really is. It's sort of from the Adrian Brody standpoint, who was the private investigator sort of looking into it. But it talks exactly, you know, with Tony Mannix and Lenora Lemon and all of the people, you know, that were involved in this. It's a great film. You should check it out. It's really, really good. So he was born George Kiefer Brewer, January 5th, 1914 in Woolstock, Iowa. His parents then separated soon after his birth, and his mother, Helen, who was a very controlling and domineering woman. I mean, I did, you know, find that out, that she
manipulative. Mm-hmm. And I say that, and I don't know if she was fully manipulative, but I say that because she full out lied to him
twice
for a good portion of, yeah, about his life. Mm-hmm. And, so yeah.
Yeah. So she was very, she played a role in him not being able to follow his dream, was, which actually boxing.
Boxing.
Yeah. And so she's, yeah,
oh,
like,
I have a quote about her, uh-huh, about that too.
Before he was even born, his biological father was out of his life. They relocated to Galesburg, Illinois, and later moved to California to stay with George's mother's sister. What she, like you mentioned earlier, what she told a young George was that his biological father had taken his own life.
Tell that lie twice?
That's why I said twice. Yes, she said that lie twice.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know she told him. Donald was the first one. I didn't know she told him that he killed himself.
Right.
I didn't even know that he knew he had a first father. Mm-hmm. But then she did it again when Frank, so they married, she married Frank March 6th, 1918.
He was 13 when Frank Pacello, was the man that she married, then yes, changed his name to George Pacello when he was 13.
Okay.
And so they later divorced with what you just mentioned, Reeves' mother telling him that he had also taken his own life.
Can you imagine? So it was after 15 years of marriage, and it said that they separated while he was away from,
right,
relatives. Mm-hmm. Right? Could you imagine just, no, leaving and then coming home?
No.
And then later on finding out, oh no, neither of them committed suicide. So they divorced. I did the math, right? So Frank ended up passing away March 4th, 1944. He was 51. Mm-hmm. If they were married for 15 years and were married in 1918, that means that they divorced in 1933, which was 11 years before his death, which, I mean, we knew it was a lie anyways, but I'm just saying, like,
yeah, that's pretty intense. And he was very close to Frank, so you can imagine what that loss was like for him. And like we mentioned, he wanted to be a boxer, but his mom did not want him to mess up his face
doing, you have boxing, too pretty a face to keep doing this.
Wow. And so then he stopped that. So acting wasn't exactly his first love or his first intention. It was the boxing that he wanted to do.
It was said that he was doing quite well. I don't know. Gary Grossman would say that George was on the Golden Gloves trajectory. He was getting somewhere until she was like, nah. Mm-mm.
Yeah, what we're not going to do is box. And so after high school, he attended the Pasadena Junior College in 1935. And then he joined the Pasadena Community Playhouse, where he would star on the main stage in a number of plays and would also sing. That's where he would meet his future wife, Eleonora Needles. They married in San Marino, California.
I feel like when you look at all of his, like, his history and his life, that it's not 100% forgotten about, but I swear, like, you have so little information on that.
Yeah.
It's like a lost 10 years of his life, you know, because, mm-hmm, they were married for 10 years before she left him.
for a man who made more money. It had been said that the reason they divorced was because she wanted children, or he, or vice versa. It was a children's thing, but she was quoted as saying it was a man with more money. I mean, after, like you said, 10 years later, they divorced. His film career began in 1939 when he was cast in a minor role in Oh Nothing, Gone with the Wind. Imagine that being your starting role. It's not like a commercial. It's not like a walk online. It's Stuart Tarleton, one of Scarlett O'Hara's suitors Gone with the Wind.
But was it big enough? Do you think that role is big enough to change your name over?
Well, if you sign away your rights, it doesn't matter, because that's exactly what he did.
Oh, I guess. Yeah, because it was like they changed two things, right? His hair color and his name. And I was like, the hair color I could get because you can always re-dye it.
Right, go back.
Whatever your natural, but your name. They thought it sounded better, maybe?
Perhaps. It was Reeves has a big connection to the Superman. So maybe it was written in the stars to have the name Reeves, who knows,
but maybe.
And of course, that was, like you mentioned, Warner Brothers, and that was with Vivien Leigh and Clark Gable. So it was a huge movie for him to be part of.
This was before he got the contract with them, right? Because he goes back to the Playhouse to play in Poncho.
Yes, but
and that's when he kind of gets
the name change. Didn't happen until after the movie premiered, because his credit was not under George Reeves.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, okay. So after the movie premiered, that's when Warner Brothers, Jack Warner's, changed his name to George Reeves. He would then go on to star in more films. He starred with Ronald Reagan, and in 1941 he did a movie called Lydia, which was a failure, and that's what made them release him from the contract after the failure of Lydia is the name of the movie.
You know, he was in Poncho and he did really well. That was a stage play at Pasadena Playhouse. He got offers at that point from the first night from Paramount, Warner Brothers, 20th Century Fox. And Warner Brothers was the first that he ended up testing with. So they just kind of like snatched him because they tested, they liked him. And from what it was said was that he had, you know, like the Warner Brother star leading quality, good looks, right?
Oh, yes, he's kind definitely.
Of, he had the jaw and his nose was broken,
broad never shoulders,
really placed.
Yeah.
So he just had this,
the look,
you know, leading man look. And then he did appear in, I mean, I wrote them down, State Cop, Ride, Cowboy, Ride Till We Meet Again, The Flight 69, Torrid Zone, Calling a Husband, Always a Bride, Strawberry Blonde, Argentina Nights, Man at Large, Blue, White, and Perfect, Blue and Sand. And then, as you mentioned, Lydia. From what I'm finding, like, and I don't mean this at all in a bad way, but I've read it, was that he wasn't an amazing actor.
Right. Yeah.
Like, and that he found a role in Superman that fit him and all of the personalities and the qualities of him. But you can see definitely in his earlier years that he really kind of, he had trouble landing anything that would really stick and get him noticed.
Superman came along. It was a Superman radio show in 1940. They did have the Kirk Allen serials on Columbia in 1948, but the first season of Superman was in 1952. Much like when we discuss, you know, Lucy, the idea of television wasn't very attractive in those days. It was kind of like a nail in a coffin sort of thing. Like, it was below theaters, movies, big film, budget films. So the idea of being on television to him wasn't as exciting at first to become, you know, Superman. So they brought this idea over to him, and he started doing that. Have you watched any of the episodes, any of the Superman episodes?
You?
I've watched a couple. It's interesting how they sort of do special effects. You know, in the 50s, it's so interesting.
Yeah.
It's cheesy now, you know, when you watch it, but it's fascinating how they were able to do some of the flying and things like that. And when he, after he did do the Westerns, is when he then went to the military. He was transferred to the First Motion Pictures Unit of the Army and the Air Forces. And that was sort of like a wasn't exactly serving. Again, we can relate back to Desi Arnaz, where he was drafted, but not necessarily serving
for entertainment purposes,
which is what a lot of the Hollywood, you know, actors and actresses would do back then.
He was amazing at memorizing lines. Yes, and so when he got into the Westerns, Teddy Sherman introduced George to her father. And they did a 7-page dialogue. It was back and forth in one take, which saved them loads of money.
It would not hold up production.
And the both of them thought, if we can do this, you know, we'll really impress them. And they did. And so that's when he started getting smaller roles in Hopalong Cassidy.
Right.
After Hopalong Cassidy, he was in So Proudly We Hail.
And they did a lot of like military type programs, which he was part of.
Well, yeah. And then I read that he enlisted in the army. He wasn't drafted.
No, he was not drafted.
Mm-hmm. And he said that he thought that maybe the reason he decided to enlist was because of So Proudly We Hail. Like, he couldn't get it out of his mind, like what they were doing in that picture, I guess, so that he wanted to be in the army himself.
The first motion picture unit of the army in Army Air Forces. So he did a lot of training films. I watched a few of those that he did. And that was pretty much his time there. And then after the war is where he came back to Hollywood, where he found conditions were poor, low budgets, rushed productions, things like that, slim pickings. He did, like you mentioned, based on his ability to remember lines and not hold up production, he was offered things. And in 1949, before he even did Superman, he went to New York, where he would do live TV and radio shows. And that's when he was then offered in 1951. He went back to LA after he was offered the role of Superman in The Adventures of Superman. He did not want to do it initially, like I said, because it was kind of a downgrade. And he did not want to just be typecast and seen as Superman for a children's television show. So he knew that once he was stuck with that role, he was married to it, and everybody would be seeing him as that. Plus, that costume was extremely heavy and rubbery, is what he meant.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
You mentioned that he moved. And he was doing some roles. Mm-hmm. He was like in the Adventures of Sir Galahad. He himself said in an interview with Long Beach Press Telegram, he said, you know, I'm not one of those 4-figure-a-week actors. This is before he got the Superman role. Mm-hmm. Don't take me wrong. I'd like to be. I can live on what I make if I work regularly. But when 5 months go by and no movie comes up, you know, you begin to worry a little, especially when you have a wife to support and a 1-acre estate to pay for. And interestingly, in the times where he was kind of like in a low bit, where he didn't have as many offers, would dig out cesspools.
Yes. And do you know how he got into that?
Yeah. So his broke, right? And he needed, or not broke, but his plumbing backed up and he needed a new cesspool. Right. And they said, okay, we'll do it for $150. He became their apprentice. I don't know if
he wanted to save some money.
How he got it, right? I don't know how he did it. Yeah, it reminds me of like a Harry thing in Here's Lucy, where he's like, well, if I do the work, but he offered to be help an assistant.
To sort of help him to pay off some and, of it.
He got to save $20. And then he went. After he learned all of that stuff, he found out that a neighbor needed digging. And I was like, "Almost, you're stealing the work from."
So he charged them only $100.
He charged them only $100. So of course they'd go with him. And that's how he got into it. And he said, you know, I'm not worrying. More and more people are moving out our way and they all need cesspools.
Yeah, that's true. So that's what he would do between jobs to sort of make money there. When he started working, doing the role of Superman, the first season was filmed over 13 weeks, two shows over 6 days. I mean, he worked and worked and worked on this. The next year it was purchased by the ABC network. He was working with a charity where he met a woman named Toni Mannix. This is the wife of Eddie Mannix, who was a fixer or enforcer in Hollywood for MGM, who would get rid of trouble for the studio. Now, another connection with Lucy is, Eddie Mannix was like we said, mentioned working for MGM. He was one who helped Desi Arnaz sort of clear every sort of permit that was needed and any clearance that was needed to run the first Isle of Lucy show. So they needed permits for housing and, you know, accommodating and fire hazards and things like that. And also kind of clear it with studios. Eddie Mannix was the guy who helped him do that. And he was sort of a guy who was a fixer and not necessarily always, that's not an official title. You know, that's just something he's known as because of what he would do. So if somebody was causing trouble for the studios, he would take care of them and whatever that means to you. If there were unwanted pregnancies, he took care of that. If there were mistresses that were causing havoc for some of our big actors or some of our, you know.
He knew how to take care of things, get rid of problems, mm-hmm. is what you're saying.
That's exactly what
just,
I'm saying.
Just so keep that in mind.
People. A powerful guy in Hollywood, his wife is having an affair. Well, begins an affair with our George Reeves.
Yes. No, it was said. It was said that, I mean, it was weird, but it was said that Eddie Mannix was all right with it.
Yes. If
you went on like these double date things.
If you watch Hollywoodland, this is portrayed there where they would do, like you just were about to say, probably double dates with each other's others.
And it's also reported that Tony Mannix purchased like a modest house for Reeves in 1950.
Oh, yes, that house where he died.
Where he died. Well, so yeah. She bought that. So in 1950, so they must have been.
Oh, like, there was more than a house. No. This woman was older. She was 8 years older than George. She would lavish him.
Sugar daddy.
Sugar mama. Yeah, sorry. She would lavish him with gifts. Homes, cars. I mean, she was very, very, very obsessed with George. And she always feared that she would be replaced by a younger person, which eventually did happen. But she always, because she knew she was older, she wasn't an actress. She was, you know, she
married.
Well, there's that. If you're gonna bring up that little
that little tidbit.
Like you've mentioned though. I don't know if it was a cheaper to keeper situation, but they were all okay with this arrangement. And what was interesting is when we get later on to the death talk is that he was okay while his wife is happy, you know, and by her being happy meant that she had this boyfriend. And if she was sad or someone broke her heart, then we have trouble, you know? And so that's an arrangement that wouldn't work for me or many others, but it worked for the Mannixes.
Yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe that gave him permission, right, to have whatever he wanted.
Oh, he definitely did. Yeah, so, he definitely did.
I do have to say that's a very open position to openly be okay with the woman sleeping around.
Yes,
in the relationship, mm-hmm. And it wasn't something that was not known, at least to people in Hollywood,
right?
So that, I mean, just because, you know, the women usually, if they stepped out, that wasn't something that was talked about proudly for sure or anything like that.
You're right, it was 1948 when he first met Tony Mannix in New York. She was a ex-Ziegfeld girl, which if you know, we know anything about old Hollywood, a lot of these starlets started off being Ziegfeld girls. And she did promise him, according to a book called The Behind the Crimson Cape, roles that never happened. So she didn't really do much for him. I think his reasoning for being with Tony was probably, you know, one of that would benefit him to get roles and things like that because she had connections to Hollywood. It never did happen outside of Hollywood after World War II. Nothing, you know, happened.
He'd
thanks
also
to her.
Lost his life, not his life, his wife. Yeah, to the extent that she left him. And so I think that maybe he was looking for that type of relationship.
Very jealous woman, you know, because as his stardom grew, as more attention, he was getting much more attention. Of course, it's not just from children, but from women. And so she would always panic that he would look in another direction and she would just be discarded.
Back to her husband.
Back to her husband.
Which again, sorry.
It's a bizarre idea. It really is.
We talked about the role of Superman for a while.
Sure.
Absolutely. That's such a big, I mean, he was Superman.
Right.
But he wasn't. And I don't want to say that because he actually really didn't like when that was said. And that was one of the things that ended up causing him his own personal turmoil was the fact that a lot of things were like, you know, and we'll talk about it, but like Superman gets in a car crash or, you know, and it's like, but no, George Reeves got in a car crash and, and he's like, I'm my own person, you know? So
I think, just on a side, can you think of an actor or actress today that is happening to them? There will always be that person.
I feel like there definitely are, but the actor who plays Joffrey in Game of Thrones.
Okay.
Was so good at what he did that people hated him, gave him like death threats and things like that.
Oh no.
And so he actually had to step out. He's coming back into the Hollywood light, but he had to take a step back because there was so much backlash. And not because they hated him as a person, but because they hated his character.
He played
and they
the role had a little really too well.
Hard, yes, they had a really hard time. So it's not what you're saying exactly, because he's going to be able to do things. I do know that Daniel Radcliffe and a lot of the Harry Potter.
Again, portrayed in the movie Hollywoodland, it shows that he, you know, he hated the idea of being stuck to this particular role, but he would turn it on and off like this because he knew how much the children loved that character. You know, it's so funny. Not funny, really. It's actually quite scary. Is, you know, he would do a lot of these appearances with children. And there was a point where a child actually brought a loaded gun to see him and to see
if he could stop a bullet,
because Superman can stop a bullet with his chest, you know? And so he told them that he had it. Again, this is portrayed in the movie as well. And so he kind of had to talk him out of it. The idea though, that this child would have shot him. It's pretty scary.
And I mean, I also read that like children would like stick him with pins and things like that, to like punch him to try to see, you know. And but he also on the other note, he had a really big heart for these children. So he would go and he would, you know, go to events where there were just a bunch of children, and he would talk to them. He would answer their questions a lot, and he was pretty honest with them, you know, when they asked how he could fly.
Okay.
But those are things that he was able to tell, you know, his stars and stuff. Oh, yeah. I mean, because he got typecast as Superman.
Right. He attempted to start his own production company, you know, his George Reeves production company.
Yeah, thought about directing.
And it did not work for him. Again, his connection to Tony, Mannix wasn't doing anything for him other than keeping him company and having his bills paid.
We skipped over what happened in 1956.
What happened in 1956?
He was on I Love Lucy.
Oh, yes, of course. Oh. Well, no. Well, see, I was just as we're going to connect and marry our shows here. Yes, he did various appearances and one infamous appearance on I Love Lucy, which we love, of course, playing Superman. We'll eventually get to cover that episode at some point. It's little Ricky's birthday and he makes an appearance because what I love is the Ricky part where he's like, Superman, can you get Superman for our, you know, for our birthday party? And he's like, yeah, sure. You can just call him up.
And they said that there's like this look on Desi's face when George flies in. That basically just shows that he was having such a good time, as good of a time with the children, if not better.
You know something? I did read where, because when he appeared with An I Love Lucy, he was still sort of in a slump, or at least probably knew that Superman was coming to an end. And he had either Desi had suggested or offered something in the Desi Lu production world. Or he asked for it or something like that. But there was a time where they were going to work together. It just never came to be.
And I was going to say, I mean, he was young. There was still so much potential. And
he was 40.
And when we get into the timeline of that night, they were celebrating getting offered something. So like, and I don't know what, we'll talk about that. And I'm sure you know, but, you know, he had, even though it wasn't, you know, looking good at that moment, amazing, you know, there's ups and downs always. And so he was just said a little bit more. And it's also stated that he was a depressed drinker. So
a heavy, heavy drinker.
Guys, what I mean by depressed drinker is that, you know, there's always, everyone's different. I don't know what you are, but there's happy drunks, there's sad drunks, there's depressed drunks, there's angry drunks. And it was said that he was a depressed drunk. So when
I've never been drunk.
Already, what?
I've never been drunk.
Really?
No. I just started drinking alcohol this year. We'll talk later about that. I had a mimosa. But... I don't drink. Yeah. So
anyway,
which goes to the theory of his death. It plays a part.
It does help, but we'll talk about that later. But continue. So we were at.
So I Love Lucy. He did that. I Love Lucy. And then after that is when the Superman was canceled. You mentioned that in 1958 is when he met Lenore Lemon, a party girl,
a cafe society girl. I was gonna say she was a society girl. She was rich.
They call her a friendly mascot for men.
Really
It was one of, yes, and so she was known to, you know, she was a staple at nightclubs, she was twice divorced, and she was very much known as a gold digger. And that was a blow to Tony Mannix, because this was the exact fear that she had came true. Not only was she being replaced, which is, you know, heartbreaking as it is. Yes, she's buried, but small potatoes.
That's a piece of paper, right?
Yes. And she was younger. She was wild. And she was just, you know, probably the opposite of her. I think she was much, Tony was, his nickname for Tony was Ma. So it tells you that, you know, her lifestyle was, you know, she was older, so her lifestyle was probably much more laid back, much more relaxed, probably just wanted to have a home with him. You know, if she could divorce her husband, Eddie, she probably would have, and, you know, stayed with him, just kind of just have a comfy, relaxing life. And Lenore was the complete opposite of that. And a drinker.
Yes. And so at this point, when he does leave her, things start to go wrong in that extent. So I know that
a decade they spent together, Tony Mannix and George Reeves. It was a whole decade, and he immediately became engaged to Lenore, which again, it was probably a huge blow to her.
But if George wanted to settle down, he was never going to be able to do that with Tony Mannix. And I think he knew that, right? They could have this
affair relationship.
And this younger affair relationship, but they were never going to have, if he wanted children, if he wanted to settle down, marriage, that type of life, he wasn't going to have a true thing, you know. But so Tony started harassing the couple.
Now, fun fact, Lenore Lemon, if you've ever seen Breakfast at Tiffany's, the Truman Capote, the Honey Go Lightly character was based on Lenore Lemon. It was written based on her.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so go ahead. Yeah, she had purchased a dog for George, and she was so upset that she kidnapped the dog.
Okay.
Which was his love. I mean, he adored this dog. And so she sort of took that dog back. And so that was
kind of. And there were other things that led them to restraining order against her.
Right.
So we said in 58, Reeves began his relationship June 16th, 1959 is when he's found dead.
This is where we start. June 15th. So,
yeah, now we get into the actual
the mystery of it all.
Of this case, mm-hmm. right?
June 15th, 1959. Now, they were at Paul's Steakhouse on Dulhaney in L.A. He went to dinner with Lenore. There was drinking. There was a piano bar. While Lenore was friendly with everyone, they were both heavily drinking at the time, witnesses said, and they go to the valet to wait for the car. They're arguing about their upcoming nuptials. It was a heated situation. So they, at the valet, they were both, you know, yelling, arguing, upset, or perhaps she wanted to marry ASAP. He was kind of stalling it. And so this was witnessed by the pianist that was there and also the valet attendant. Here's what's crazy. He was 2.7 was the what his blood alcohol level was, which is twice the legal limit, which is insane to think that this man was able to drive his vehicle up. Now, if you know anything about these canyon streets up in Hollywood, they're very windy and they go up. And I mean, just sober is hard enough. If you're tired or sober, it's hard enough to kind of manage these streets. You know, it's up to you to kind of decide, did he drive himself or did someone drive, or what was the case there? 2.7 is almost...
I mean, okay, listen.
I can't even stand.
Depends on how heavy of a drinker he was. So, and how consistent. So I worked at a drug and alcohol rehab center, and we would have people come in and they would have to, you know, do a breathalyzer. Mm-hmm. And there would be people 0.3, you know, 0.25, 0.3. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't tell. You'd be like, oh, okay, they're a little drunk, but nothing too bad. And then they'd blow these, you know, outrageous numbers. But also how much of you build up a tolerance. So okay. How big your mm-hmm. tolerance is. Got and it. Then if you have one, then, you know, that could be nothing. That could make you just feel a little bit drunk.
Well, so. I guess according to what they had, they're saying that it was almost virtually impossible to drive without causing a crash, without going off this windy road. Again, they're very narrow, the road to his home. And they said that Lenore was nearsighted. So they're wondering, she didn't drive. So let's assume that he did.
He did get into a car accident. I can't remember. I think it was in 1959 or 1958.
Yeah. Now that
he got into a car accident.
He did. That was a car accident that was very suspicious because they also found that his brakes
were cut.
That could have been Miss Mannix. That could have been Miss Mannix's husband. That could have been Miss Lenore. We don't know. But yes. And after that accident, he was, you know, quite hurt, and he was on some heavy medication as well, which may or may not have played a part in what happened on June 15th. He also was on medication for that because he was always in a lot of pain after that car accident. So we start with them being at his home on Benedict Canyon. And I have it sort of lined up here as option 1, 2, and 3. Okay. We can go over a couple of ones. Option 1. Okay, I have around 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock. Oh, first, let me just say it was Lenore, George Reeves that night. And then the guest room above the garage was Carol Van Ronkel and writer Robert Condon. They were also there. Around 12 or 1 o'clock, William Bliss came over to the party. Now, William Bliss was the only one who wasn't really a friend of theirs. Like, he wasn't really familiar with him. So just this random neighbor came over to hang with them. Okay. And he's also the one that went and found the body and was the only one who reacted like, maybe we should go see if he's okay. The stranger, the one who wasn't familiar with him, as opposed to the friends and the girlfriends, which is bizarre. So around 12, 1 o'clock, Will and Bliss comes over to the party. Reeves was upset about all the noise that's going on. Like, I'm trying to sleep, right? He probably was exhausted from the drinking, who knows? And he goes upstairs. They hear a single gunshot, right? And they find his naked body facing upward, feet on the floor. The crime scene is that under George's back is a shell casing. No burn on his back, bullet from his head and ceiling in the wall area. Police said they were all very drunk and it was difficult to get statements. That's option 1. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I already murdered, or that he was... killed himself.
Right. This is the suicide notion.
Suicide. Mm-hmm. While he went upstairs after they were talking, after he went back upstairs, she said, you know, he's going to shoot himself. And then when the bedside drawer opens, you know, she followed it up with, he's getting a gun out now, he's going to shoot himself.
Right. She's quoted as downstairs saying, there he goes. Which, he's going to go up there to kill himself. Now,
right.
If you thought that was going to happen,
why wouldn't you do anything? Like, if you seriously thought, like, hey, my husband's, you know, and not to just say it once, right? But then to say it a second time, like, aren't you going to go upstairs and check?
React.
And these comments, you know, they said that it's just because she was drunk. But I was like, even if you're drunk, wouldn't you want to?
Now, the man is up. Okay, let's go with the theory of suicide. The man is found naked. Now, I know that people with.
Maybe you know, sleep naked.
People with mental illness, depression, things like that will decide to harm themselves in a variety of ways at different times. We don't know. Who are we to decide? But it's almost like there's a story out of San Diego here where a woman was supposedly took her own life by hanging off the balcony nude and tying herself off this rich man's balcony up here. And it's called Coronado is the town in San Diego. And she's completely nude. She just happens to jump off the balcony, you know, for the world to see her naked body. And they say, of course it was first thought of as murder and things like that, because for the most part, women are not going to do that. They're not going to expose themselves like that. If anything, you're going to, you know, medication, things like that. You're not going to expose yourself that way. Of course, there's no rules to this, but would he do this when he was naked?
Yeah, you know, and I had that same thought in all honesty. Like, so he's going to come upstairs, strip, get the gun and shoot himself?
Right.
Why not just shoot yourself in what you're wearing? You know, like, it's just, it's weird. The fact that it took them 45 minutes, the fact that there was no fingerprints on the gun. I mean,
there's a lot of shoddy.
Did he police like work shoot here. Himself and then as yeah. he's dying, wipe off the, no, I'm just that. But yeah. then there was also two more bullets.
Oh, no, yes. We'll get into that. This is just one option.
Oh, so, I'm sorry. No. I'm saying I don't like the option. It's a no-go for me.
It's a no-go for you.
I don't think that it was suicide.
Option two, they believe that there was an argument that started from the restaurant, carried on, right? And perhaps Lenore grabbed his gun, fired two shots onto the ground as sort of a warning shot, so he wouldn't leave her. And perhaps she also has some sort of indication and inside information that he wanted to go back with Tony, because maybe he has some sort of stability with Tony and this girl was just too much.
Yeah.
And perhaps struggled with the gun and went off and shoots George. I don't think you like that one because you don't think that that's a possibility. Struggling with the gun.
The place in which he was shot. I mean, to accidentally shoot someone in the temple. Right. Cause that's where.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So like to accidentally shoot someone there just seems like it wouldn't work.
Right.
But it's hard for me. So maybe not an accident, but I could see it maybe being a murder from her.
Option three, which is the lesser believed, but there's also something to it, is that a hitman was hired on the order of Eddie Mannix, who was believed to have mafia ties because of the pain that he caused Mrs. Mannix. Now, or that Mrs. Mannix did it herself, that Tony did it herself. Somehow she snuck into the house and was able to, you know, gain access to his room and waited and shot him. How she left, I don't know. They've seen the window layout. It's almost impossible to do that, but who knows?
They were also drunk.
They were very inebriated. And they yes.
didn't go up for 45 minutes.
Yes. Now, the terrible police work comes in here because the reason we have all these random information is because how quickly this case was closed. Within a week, it was considered a suicide. That's it. We're done. Okay. The guy took his own life. There was no gunshot residue on his hands. Now, what sort of black magic did he perform that he was able to not? And they said perhaps he was, he showered or someone. Well, I guess he could shower post shooting the gun, but I'm saying that someone washed him off, and they said that that's not always foolproof. That's not always going to be, it's not always going to remove all the residue off your hands. There was no gunpowder, no fingerprints on the gun. Okay. It was a 30 caliber Luger knockoff. And
people say that it was too recently oiled to retain fingerprints.
And
which yeah, I don't
Yeah. There were no calls to the police for 60 to 80 minutes. Now, why? Why would you not call right away? And there was no proof of any rearranging. And unfortunately, everybody from the story is dead. You know, we're never going to know. And so the suicide story was never okay with anybody who knew George, especially his mother, who was his biggest defender in this. There were sort of conflicting stories about a seventh season, but there was, when you speak to his co-star, who was Lois Lane, Phyllis Coates, she says that they were working on something together and he was very excited, looking forward to it. So there's no reason for him to want to take his own life. And his mother said, there's no way that he took his own life. You know, she immediately pointed the finger at Lenore.
Which of the two do you want to look at, Lenore, or do you want to look at Eddie Mannix first?
Let's start with the least plausible. Let's go with Eddie Mannix.
Eddie Mannix. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you say the least plausible, but I don't know if I fully agree, but the temper that was very well known. And I personally, like, if I'm thinking she was the one who was slighted, Tony Mannix, I almost feel like she would be the one that would want to kill him.
She would have more of the reason.
I feel like she would have the reason. She would be the one that would really, yeah, push for that, I guess. Not push for it, but like, want that
in the heat of heartbreak, perhaps. She
exactly not, yeah. Like if I can't have you, you yes. know, I don't want anyone else to. Mm-hmm. It was in 1999, Ed Losey mm-hmm. claimed that before her death, a bedridden Tony confessed to a priest,
right,
that she had George killed. So I guess that would say, to your point, that she had a hitman, which I guess, again, if she didn't want to get her hands dirty, and that she, you know, none of those people were still alive anymore. So now she felt safe to talk about it.
Because everybody was gone.
Because everyone was gone. And she confessed because she was terrified about going to hell.
Now, what's interesting is that night, to this same theory, Phyllis Coates, who played Lois Lane on Superman Adventures, received a call at 4:30 in the morning from Tony, stating and yelling, "Our boy is dead. The boy is dead. Our boy is dead." How was she so aware of it so immediately at 4:30 in the morning?
Yeah, because when did they call? I mean,
did she immediately have a source down at the police station that let her know of this event, or did she have some prior knowledge to it? And I think
it was going to happen.
That it was going to happen, or that it was
possibly
done.
That was never that yay or nay. No one else said, like, yeah, she confessed for a tabloid TV show. So we have to keep that in mind as well.
Yeah, I think it was Entertainment Tonight, I think, or Unsolved
Extra.
Mysteries. Extra. Okay.
It's called Extra.
Yeah.
Though I believe that she had the means to do it, and she had the reason, the motive. So she had means and motive. I am also leaning towards Lenore.
Yeah, so the Lenore theory, again, like we mentioned, that she was probably upset about the fact that he was either breaking up with her, it wasn't going her way, he wasn't marrying her as quickly as she wanted, maybe he wanted to get back with Tony, a variety of reasons, or just being drunk and stupid, doing something ridiculous. They got into a fight and she murdered the guy. Now, here's what's interesting. The terrible police work here is that maybe like the next day or hours later after the death occurred and it was sealed off, Lenore actually broke the seal to go pick up these traveler's checks that only she was aware of, that supposedly were going to be for a honeymoon.
Honeymoon.
Right. And so she went and grabbed these traveler's checks and just hightailed it back to New York within that week. And again, there were gunshots holes underneath the rug of where he laid. And she said, oh, it was just something that we accidentally did. And the cops were like, okay, and sort of accepted that reasoning as to why there were more gunshots underneath him. Nice. Which is not. Now, here's what's interesting as well. The mother sent a telegram to the funeral home. Now, I say funeral home because they sent the body to the funeral home before they sent it to the morgue, which is completely unusual. And they embalmed the body before performing an autopsy. And you know what embalming does to a body? It makes it almost impossible to perform an autopsy.
Right. So,
and he had wounds that were not accounted for. There were, you know, like kind of bruises and bumps and things like that. She sent a telegram to the funeral home and said, do not cremate him until I get there. She was his next of kin. They cremated him before she got there.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Without her approval.
Like they maybe had something to hide.
Now to cremate a body, you need approval. And so you would do it, you know, if it's a wife, it'd be a husband. If it's a child, it'd be a, you know, parent. Here, it would be her. She did not approve of this. So who did? Someone signed off for the cremation of this man's body. The mother immediately hired an attorney, of course, to find out what the heck just happened. Lenore Lemon travels back to New York within a week. And that's that. You know, you mentioned earlier about auto accidents. There were other potential attempts on this man's life. You know, that's what he was on medications for. I think we spoke of that because of the auto accident. So those are the mysterious options that are left for this man's death. And he is currently interred at the Mountain View Cemetery and Mausoleum in Altadena, California. I think I should go out and visit that. I've seen a few graves and never seen his. But yeah, that's what makes this story up until 2022 very fascinating. Because it's
unsolved, you know.
It is unsolved. Well, not according to LAPD.
Well, right. It was officially solved. And it was so quickly and close. And you would think with someone in such a public eye that they'd want to know for sure, for certain, 100%, was this really a suicide? I don't know. I definitely, my vote is for Lenore.
Yes. Only because if your fiance did in fact take his own life, first of all, the quote of her saying, you know, he's about to go do it, that's not how one would behave, number one. Number right. two is your initial response after him having taken his own life to rush back, cut the crime scene tape, and take your traveler's checks that you supposedly were for your honeymoon, and no one ever knew of this, and take off back to New York. No, she didn't even attend his funeral. And it said that after that, Tony went into a heavy depression. She became a recluse, and, you know, until she passed, or perhaps that deathbed confession that you spoke of. But it's a lot, and it's unfortunate because it just sounded like he had a sort of depressive time in his life post Superman. It ended up this way. Either one is a tragic scenario. If he was way too depressed, he took his life, that's horrific. If his girlfriend did it, that's terrible. If the lover had someone do it, or the lover's husband have someone do it, that's terrible. So none of these are good answers.
Yeah, they're all terrible.
They're all terrible. This is one of those, again, murder mysteries, or death mysteries, really, because we don't know, that that we'll be doing. Our next one will be Bob Crane. Yep. I don't know any of his death, so I'm really looking forward to knowing about him.
He was the star on Hogan's Heroes.
Hogan's Heroes, okay.
Yep.
Which we can find a Desi Lu connection to.
Yes, and we'll talk about that when we do this next episode. So
yeah, so
thank you guys for listening.
Let us know again, what you think of
please
these.
Do. Stories. Let us know.
Yeah.
Tell us what you what you think of the new episode
and
of
your
us
theories.
Doing more of these, and then also too, yes, your theories, what you think happened.
Yeah, and suggestions for any more, because I enjoy looking
more.
These up. These are fun.
Yes.
Yeah. So thanks, guys, and find us on Having a Ball Pod on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, YouTube, Facebook,
everywhere.
All the places, everywhere. Bye, guys.
Bye.